Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. On today's show, the company that plans to build one of the world's most advanced electric cars at a plant in Hanford has been rocked by a financial and leadership crisis. We'll find out how a new $1 billion investment could help get Faraday Future back on track as we talk with reporter Sean O'Kane from The Verge. We'll also talk with Bob Smith of the Bakersfield City Council and learn why the city is exploring a possible tax increase to boost a city budget that could have a $15 million shortfall in 5 years' time. We'll find out what's behind rising costs and why the public is being asked to weigh in through a survey. We begin, though, with a look at a new law that's taking effect January 1st that has a big impact throughout the valley, SB 54, California's new sanctuary state law. When the bill was in the legislature, Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims was one of its biggest critics. For years, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers have worked hand-in-hand with those inside the Fresno County Jail. So how will all this change come January 1st? Last Friday, I sat down with Sheriff Mims inside her office to find out about that and also about an ongoing investigation into at least 10 drive-by shootings that have taken place in rural Fresno County. Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims joins us today on Valley Public Radio. Sheriff Mims, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back.
So you were one of the biggest critics of SB 54 when it was making its way through the legislature. It is now law, taking effect January 1st. What is changing on a daily basis in the operation that you supervise here with the Fresno County Jail?
Well, primarily, there are certain offenses that we will not be able to advise ICE about regarding some of our inmates. So, for instance, if they've had multiple DUIs, that's an offense we're not able to let ICE know about. Or if they have gang membership, even though they might have misdemeanor convictions, if they're an active gang member, that would be of concern, especially to the people of Fresno County, as well as me. And those are the kinds of things we cannot tell ICE about any longer.
So in the past, ICE agents had actually been in the jail, had access to your computers and those sorts of things, and release dates. So there's a lot of coordination. Is that going to be taking place anymore?
ICE can no longer have access to our database. However, they do get access to anything that's public information. And we publish publicly when people get arrested on our website, as well as when they are released. So at that time, ICE can actually check who is being booked and who's being released. They also can register, like the public can, for our VINE system. It's the victim notification system, where if there's somebody that they're interested in that we are prohibited from telling them about, they can actually register with our VINE system and be notified when that person is released. So it's going to be clumsy. However, I think there are ways that we're going to be able to communicate with ICE in a way that maximizes public safety. And I'm more concerned also about the unintended consequences as far as the Senate bill.
What would those unintended consequences be in your view?
For instance, if ICE takes somebody into custody now, they find out through our public sources that somebody's going to be released, and then they pick them up from the jail lobby. We are not able, for instance, like we were in the past, to pass on medical information that that inmate might need. For instance, they may be a day-to-day diabetic, need insulin. They might have mental health issues and on certain medications. But because we can't communicate with ICE about that person, we are prohibited from sharing some potential harmful medical information that that inmate may need. Also, if ICE cannot do their job in our jail in a safe, controlled environment, they're going to do it out in our community. So my concern is now, rather than being able for ICE to come into the jail, take somebody into custody, if this person is able to get back to their community, ICE is going to be in our communities doing their job. And they're not just going to take that person into custody. Anybody that's with them, they're going to be checking immigration status, which I believe is going to harm the feeling that the public has when it comes to their own safety.
So you're saying that you would foresee a situation where ICE might be more active in doing raids out in communities in Fresno County?
Correct. If they have somebody they want and they can't take them into custody while they're in jail, and we have to release that person is going to go back to their home, and ICE is going to still do their jobs. They're going to be going out into our communities, out to workplaces, out to locations where they think they're going to find this person and take them into custody.
Does this law change in any significant way what your deputies do out in the field?
It does not affect in any way what the deputies do out in the field because we do not do frontline immigration enforcement. If we come across somebody in the field, we deal with the actual incident. We do not ask what their immigration status is. In fact, we want people in our communities, if they've been victimized, to tell us about it. We do not work with ICE when it comes to victims of crimes. In fact, we can actually help victims of crimes be here legally by recommending a U visa, which allows them to stay in the country for up to 3 years legally if they're involved in the criminal prosecution.
How does this new bill, for lack of a better term, build on what was already state law under the Trust Act? There are a number of crimes that bill, which passed back, I think it was in 2014, outlined as ones that agencies could hold people on and then communicate that with ICE. How does this sort of tear off that?
Well, it goes a step further in restricting that law enforcement agency's ability to access our databases. The overarching issue that really troubles me is we have a state legislature telling us which federal law enforcement agency we cannot talk to, which is not good for law enforcement, and it's not good for our public safety. My fear is who's going to be next? Are they going to restrict access and communication between the DEA or the ATF or the FBI? I don't think it's the role of legislators to tell us who we can and can't talk to and to what extent.
So the ICE agents that were in the jail, are they still there right now at the end of December, and then they're leaving at midnight on the 31st. What's the status there?
One of the things that really helped this bill get better than what it was originally written for was when the governor got involved. Governor Brown worked with the author of the bill, and they actually removed the caveat that ICE could not physically be inside the jail. So ICE can still be in the jail. We cannot provide a permanent office or permanent desk for them, but we never did anyway. So any law enforcement agency can actually come into our jail and do their business. What they're not able to do, like other law enforcement agencies, is access our database.
Attorney General Sessions has talked about the administration's concern about this law and about communities in California specifically that have adopted a variety of their own local sanctuary state measures and has talked about enforcement on that from the federal level. There's grants, there's other things. Are you concerned about that? And if so, in what areas could Fresno County be potentially in jeopardy with enforcement actions from DOJ?
Well, I believe that we are working as closely as we possibly can with Homeland Security and with all of our federal immigration partners. What I suggested to some federal agencies is don't punish law enforcement when we're trying to do the right thing by withholding grants and money from law enforcement. If they want to punish somebody, like the state of California, do it through the pass-through money. A lot of federal money passes through the state. They can stop doing that, and that might be a choice that they have because The state probably takes 10 or 15% off of all pass-through money just to administrate those funding. So if they want to punish the state, that's one thing. But don't try to punish law enforcement agencies that are doing their best, like the sheriff's office in Fresno County, to keep our communities safe when we're really trying to do the right thing by keeping them safe.
How much does the sheriff's office depend on federal funds?
It's not a lot of money. We really many times, here's the way I look at federal funds. If there's a large match or if it's a short-term grant, we don't apply because sometimes there are so many strings attached that it's not worth the money that we get. So we do a good job with leveraging the amount of money that we get through taxes. I mean, that's what I believe people pay their taxes for, it is to get quality law enforcement. So it's not a lot of money, maybe up to between $5 and $6 million. And when you think about our total budget is over $200 million, you know, it's a little bit. It is a little bit, but it's something that I hope the administration doesn't do when agencies are trying to do their best to work in partnership with the Department of Justice.
We're joined by Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims. Sheriff Mims, you have an ongoing investigation right now that's of utmost priority. This is getting even national media attention. 10 drive-by shootings from a passing car in a rural area outside of the city of Fresno, around Kerman Highway 145, even extending into Madera County. What is the status of this investigation?
Well, what we've done so far is determined that we have a pretty good general description of a suspect vehicle. And it's a dark-colored pickup with an extended cab that's lifted and has large tires on it. And the status of the investigation is we've really put a lot of resources into this investigation, not only us, but the Madera County Sheriff's Office as well as the California Highway Patrol. Two of those shootings in Madera County, 8 of them in Fresno County. I'm very surprised we only have one person that's been injured as a result of this. And we're putting these resources out there and making this very public in the effort to stop it and make sure that we don't have a murder investigation instead of just a drive-by shooting where vehicles are harmed.
Is there any sort of common thread between the victims here?
These shootings appear to be completely random. The suspect committing these crimes is doing so when there's no other vehicles in the vicinity. So it's a crime of opportunity. It's completely random. I know that we certainly don't want to stop our public from going about their day-to-day business, but we need to catch who's responsible before someone is killed.
Talk, if you can, about how potentially dangerous this is and how fortunate the individuals who have been shot are given the nature of this type of shooting.
The way this is happening is as the vehicles pass each other on the roadway, the suspect is shooting into the other vehicle. And so by the time the person in the other vehicle realizes something has happened, they hear something hit the car, the suspect vehicle is already down the road. And then the victim may wait until they get to their destination. And in a couple of cases, they've waited a couple of days before they call us, which makes it very difficult for us to try and address it at the time that it's happening. What I'm concerned about, again, is that somebody is going to get killed in this because it is it's certainly not an accurate way to try and hurt somebody, but it's just a matter of inches, and in some cases, millimeters, if somebody is not truly injured. My concern also is how many times has this happened where maybe the shooter has tried to shoot a vehicle and missed, or how many people are out there that this has happened to and haven't reported? We only know about 10 of these instances.
Is there any precedent for something like this that's happened in recent memory in Fresno County?
Yeah, we know we've had these cases before. In fact, I probably about 10 years ago, we had cases where school buses were being targeted, and we finally found the person, but the school buses with kids on board. And, you know, bullets are indiscriminate. They are going to harm anybody, and they're very irresponsible, cowardly acts by people who may feel this is thrilling, to shoot at other vehicles. But when they get locked up and prosecuted, it's the thrill is gone.
What's your message to the public, especially people who might be in that terrible situation that those other 10 individuals have been?
My recommendation is that, first of all, get to a place of safety if this happens to you, and then call us immediately. We have a lot of resources out there, the Fresno County Sheriff's Office, the Madera County Sheriff's Office, as well as the California Highway Patrol. We are ready, and we're staged, and when this happens, please give us a call as soon as possible so we can get out there and catch the person responsible.
And the reward has increased.
So when this first happened, the Central Valley Crime Stoppers stepped up and gave us a $3,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of this person. And this can be anonymous. Since then, a local business person has anonymously matched that reward. So now it's up to $6,000 for information to catch who's responsible for this.
Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims joining us today. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. In August, electric automaker Faraday Future announced that an old tire factory in Hanford would be the new site for the company's factory. They promised that by the end of 2018, the plant would begin turning out the futuristic FF91, a luxurious all-electric vehicle that executives claimed would outperform Tesla's top models with a price tag close to $200,000. But the celebration that day in Hanford also led to skepticism locally and in the tech industry. The announcement in Hanford came weeks after the company scuttled plans for a $5 billion factory in Las Vegas. Even worse, Faraday faced a cash crunch tied to the financial problems of its principal investor, Chinese billionaire Jiayu Teng. Since then, things haven't gone especially well for the company, with the departure of many top executives and reports that work at the firm had essentially ground to a halt. But now comes word that Jiayu Teng has raised $1 billion in capital to keep the LA-based company going and has stepped in as CEO. So what does this mean for Hanford and for the ambitious plans of Faraday Future? Reporter Sean O'Kane has been covering this issue extensively for the tech industry publication The Verge. He joins us now on the phone. Sean, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Sean, I want to talk about this infusion of cash that could change the fortunes of Faraday Future in a moment, but let's take a step back and look at what's changed since August, when several hundred employees from the LA office of Faraday came up to Hanford to celebrate this new facility, actually an old facility, but one that they hope to move into. Since then, you've had several top executives leave, Stefan Kraus and Ulrich Kranz, both former BMW guys. They were the ones who were brought in to sort of fix the company. What happened to them?
Yeah, I've had it described to me by more than one employee that Kraus was viewed internally as, quote, the savior of the company. And you can understand why. This is a guy who had spent years at BMW and was also an executive at Deutsche Bank. And so, you know, if you're going to have somebody come in to a company when you're in a major cash crunch where you're essentially have no money coming in, somebody like that is probably the person you want in place. The problem that really arose with Kraus during his time at the company, and with Kranz, who he brought over a few months later after he joined Faraday Future, was that the company had clearly been mostly out of money, or was only keeping enough money coming in to keep the lights on. And when you're in that situation, it's not like somebody who is going to come in as a savior is going to be able to just sort of snap their fingers and make all the problems go away. What he had done, and this was described to me by multiple former employees, at relatively high levels within the company, was prepare essentially three tracks for the company, one that maybe they would be able to get, you know, what would we do if we got a major cash infusion from an investor or a group of investors? What would happen if we were able to sell off parts of the business to other OEMs to keep the production possibility alive? And then the third was, what would it look like if we declared Chapter 11 bankruptcy? And where could we move the company forward if that were the path we went down? And from what I was told by all these people is that, you know, Jiawei Ting wasn't particularly psyched about selling parts of the business. He wasn't particularly psyched about bringing in new investors because it would potentially dilute his majority stakeholder ownership in the company. And he wasn't really happy about the idea of Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And so as he put up this resistance to the things that he had brought Stefan Krause in to prepare the company for, Krause sort of just got fed up and resigned in October. And that was done sort of on the quiet. What had happened, we didn't learn in the public about it, and us journalists didn't even learn about it until November, when it sort of came out that he had left the company. And then a day later, after that word broke, the company released a press release saying they had fired him, that he had done illegal things, and that they were going to take legal action. None of that legal action has happened, and it's been more than a month now. So there was a pretty heated moment there in November, but from all accounts, from all the people that I've spoken to, he resigned in October and was willing to work with the company to try to come back and help them out as long as they met certain terms. But they weren't willing to meet those terms. And then, you know, this sort of public excoriation of him happened.
And you're reporting that he and Krause are now working on their own company, their own electric car company.
Yeah, so a sort of competitor publication to us, Electric, posted this news that they were working on this company called eVelocity. And I was able to confirm that that's the case. They have a whole bunch of ex-Faraday Future talent. Some of the bigger names, it seems, that have left the company in the last couple of months already on board. But this is certainly not, I mean, it's unique in the sense that, like, they have some of the biggest names to have come out of Faraday Future, it seems, but it's not unique in the sense that of the now at least dozens, if not far more than that, that have left Faraday Future in the last couple months, many of them have gone on already, you know, even publicly on LinkedIn to say that they work for other electric car startups. There seems to be, you know, more and more by the day. And so this company, which had grown at one point to almost 1,500 employees, is now down back under 1,000. And so that sort of die-off of talent is becoming a major sort of seeding for all these other companies that are out there trying to grow.
Now, a few days ago, you published an in-depth piece about the woes of Faraday and what's happening in the company's culture and the crisis that has really engulfed the firm. You paint a picture of employees not showing up to work, extravagant purchases, estates, Lamborghinis, alleged mismanagement. What was the scene like at company headquarters there from the people you've talked to?
The piece really revolves around, there was always a disconnect with Faraday Future. It had been sort of partially co-founded by Jiawei Ting, who had been the founder and CEO of Leico, which is a tech conglomerate in China. But the company always kept him sort of at a distance in the way that they would refer to him. They would admit as much that he was the main financial backer and that he was an investor, that he was a shareholder in the company. But they always tried to make it seem like the relationship stopped there and that this was an independent company that was an American car company in California. And the more I dug into it, the more that seemed to not be the case. And he, over time, originally in the first year or two, he was directing the company's biggest sort of scope decisions, like how many cars would they want to make a year? How many models would they want to make? But by this past year, as he ran into more troubles with Leico in China, he wound up over here staying in the United States and therefore just taking more time to exert more control in the day-to-day at Faraday Future. Now, this whole year has been a big financial struggle for Faraday Future, because since he was the main investor and since he ran into financial troubles in China in the, sort of throughout 2016, those payments that he had been making to the company started to dry up. And so 2017, excuse me, was a relatively lean year with most of the company's influx of cash going right back into the payroll and pretty much nowhere else. And so the way this was affecting employees, the vibe that I've gotten is that a lot of people there had already put in a lot of work to design this FF91. A lot of people still believe that, you know, while some things might be going up at the top level of this company that they might not be on board with, they wanted to see through this project that they had all been brought there to create. And so they were willing to stay through as executives started to leave and things started to look a little iffy about how long the company might be around. And a lot of people had told me, you know, people are really riding it out. First off, they're getting paid pretty well. The company had started off with enough money that they were paying the employees like higher than most other companies similar to it would. So they were making decent money, and then they were willing to at least stick around as long as Stefan Kraus and Richard Kim, who was the lead designer on the FF91. As long as those two executives are there, that was what a lot of people told me people were waiting for. If they go, then other people will go. And then Kraus was gone, we knew of, in November, and then Richard Kim actually left right around Thanksgiving. And so it was at that point that I think a lot of people started jumping ship. And also just, I think a lot of pretty smart recruiters in the tech industry and automotive industry probably knew there was this gigantic pool of people getting antsy at this company. And so, you know, people have gone on not just to other EV startups, but Amazon, Apple, Tesla. I mean, two of the comms people that I worked with, you know, in trying to confirm things as, over my time of reporting with Faraday Future, two of those people in the communications department have already left for Tesla and another company. So it's throughout the company there. It's everybody from comms to vehicle line manufacturing to design and everything like that.
So two of the biggest questions about Faraday's future, so to speak, have been who's running the company and is there enough cash to keep the doors open? I guess those have been answered with this latest news. Tell us what we know about what broke on Wednesday.
Yeah, so word started to go around actually even right before I published the big story that I published last week. That there might be new money coming into the company, that Ja had gone out and secured some kind of investment, but it was a little bit unclear who it would be from or how much it might be. Up until that point, I had been told the company only really had enough cash on hand to pay the payroll through the end of the year. And so this week, it started being reported by a few Chinese outlets without a ton of direct sourcing that they had somehow sourced a $1 billion investment, which sort of lined up with what I had heard from my own sources before I published my story. But like this was now out there. I was digging a little bit deeper, and I've been able to confirm at least that they have cash. They have enough new cash to start not only keep paying the payroll, but start paying back some of the suppliers that they owe money to, which Bloomberg recently reported they have about $100 million or more in debt from just what they owe to suppliers. But they have at least some money. A billion is sort of a ballpark figure. It's still a little bit murky whether or not that's exactly what they've sourced or how far along the process they are. What I've been told is it's a group of companies out of Asia from a couple different countries. And that big, it's a big number for sure, and it would value the company at an even bigger rate. What I've been told, at least, is that it is not like they're getting $1 billion now. Whatever that final figure is, it's probably a long-term investment. It is something that they're going to need to hit certain production goals, probably the ones they've already stated, like getting a car off the line in 2018, getting X number a week in 2019. That will unlock sort of the rest of that investment along the way. But what we know now is that they at least have enough money to start paying back suppliers. And their payroll was $12 million or so a month, and that was, you know, before some employees left. I don't know exactly what it is now, but so you can assume that if they're paying back suppliers, what I've been told is they're, you know, the cash that they've gotten is somewhere in the hundreds of millions of dollars right now.
And who is running the firm at this point?
So, I mean, it had sort of been mostly Jia Weiting. Most of the founding executives, there were five core executives that were brought on to run the company in the early days. Only two of them are left right now. And in this meeting where Jia announced to employees at the company last week that they had secured some investment. He also announced that he was taking over as CEO, which is something that I had heard in the weeks before anyways, that he was sort of taking on the title. Whether or not they're ever going to really make that public, I'm not sure. They have always been cagey about their leadership, not just in the ways I described before, but they've really just never honestly had a public-facing CEO, which is strange, but they've had people on paper in different filings with different states and stuff who have listed themselves as CEO. And that's actually part of the report that I did, which was investigating this other person at the company who's really been in charge of the money there, who had listed herself as CEO a few different times. But as far as we know, he's the CEO now. He's said he's committed to getting this car out in the American market. I mean, they're now set up to continue with the plan in Hanford, at least in the short term. And I recently spoke to city manager Daryl Pyle over there, and they sound really excited. The idea for them is, hey, like this is, like you said, this is a plant that's been around. They've had a lot of interest in it over the years, but people hadn't really bid on finally getting in there and doing the work necessary to get it back up and running for whatever it may be. At one point, it was maybe even going to be a medical marijuana facility. But you know, they have a tenant in there now. That tenant is going to hopefully create jobs for the city of Hanford, somewhere on the order of about 1,300. The city is there ready in a support role if and when Faraday Future gets going, which they should sometime start construction in early 2018, from what I was told from the city of Hanford. And so that's sort of their perspective on things. It's not like they're spending every day, you know, putting money into this project or waiting around for it. They're just ready to support the company, which to its credit has been working with the city of Hanford through all the troubles that it's had since August and even before that. It's had representatives of the company in Hanford. I mean, Dag Reckhorn, who has led the project from Faraday Future's side, has been speaking at the Rotary Club in Hanford. I mean, they've been there doing the work. It's just sometimes a little bit hard to see through all the sort of chaos at the rest of the company.
You can find Sean O'Kane's reporting on Faraday Future online at TheVerge.com. We will continue to follow his coverage and the story out of Hanford as the ambitious company plans to start building the FF91 all-electric vehicle at the old Pirelli factory in Hanford sometime next year. We'll see if that actually plays out. I'm sure there'll be a lot more twists and turns in this story in 2018. Sean, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. While the stock market is up, many cities in the Valley are still struggling. Bakersfield perhaps faces the biggest cash crunch, as rising costs tied to health care and retirement expenses have combined with the regional economy that is struggling due to a decline in activity in the oil industry. Now the city council is considering what to do about the shortfall, and that could, and again I emphasize could, include a tax increase. Here to tell us more is Bob Smith, who represents Ward 4 on the Bakersfield City Council and also serves as vice mayor. Bob, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So before we get into how the city might go about fixing this situation, let's talk about the problem itself. How big is this shortfall that you're looking at right now, at least based on the projections that you have from the city?
Well, it's out in the future. What we're trying to do is think ahead. I had the staff present, you know, kind of a 5-year timeline, and our Cal, like you mentioned, our CalPERS and health costs continue to rise, and because of the oil economy and really sales tax revenue in general, retail is down because of online shopping, and so those are the problems we're trying to address.
So you have a what's estimated around a $5 million budget shortfall next year, and then it could grow $5 to $8 million depending on the scenario that you look at, and that could grow as much as $15 million over in 5 years' time?
Yes, that is correct.
So let's look at the revenue side of things. You mentioned the sales tax dollars are declining. How much of that do you think is attributed to just what's happening regionally in Kern County right now with what we've seen over the last couple of years with the oil industry and the doldrums that it's been in? How much of that do you think contributes to this?
Oh, I think it's absolutely tied to the oil industry. And in 2012, 13, and 14, we were seeing, you know, increasing economy locally when the oil was up. And then when oil bottomed out, it directly affected the Bakersfield, Kern County economy.
On the revenue side, you have relatively limited options there. Sales tax is one of those, and I want to get into that as a potential solution. But is this something that city leaders have looked at in the past?
You know, I think in the past, before I got on the council, they had tried sales tax for transportation only measures, and they were not successful. You know, I think Fresno's had one for the last 40 years. Actually, Bakersfield is one of the few places in California that has no additional sales tax beyond the state sales tax. I think I looked up, and there's like 92% of the population in the state has an additional sales tax, but Bakersfield does not.
Right now, let's look at the expense side with City Hall. Cities across the state have been hit by the decisions recently by CalPERS to lower their projections. How much of that is part of this budget crunch?
Well, it's a large part of it. Like I said, you know, the economy going down on top of CalPERS complicates the issue for us. If we were having increased, you know, growth in economy, you know, perhaps we could handle it. But the growth in CalPERS is definitely the driving force.
And right now, CalPERS is estimated to have an unfunded liability statewide of $153 billion, with, again, according to the San Jose Mercury News, only 68% of the assets that it should have, again, dealing with these projections that they have for paying for state retirement for public employees. These are obligations the city has made. You can't cut those, can you?
No, I think even cities that have went bankrupt have not been successful in getting out of their pension obligations. And so I don't believe there's any alternative but to figure out, you know, how to pay them.
Now, I imagine there's many people in this part of the area. This is a relatively conservative part of the state, largely a strong political voice for anti-tax or reduced tax policies. I can imagine many people listening right now and saying, Bob, why can't you just cut spending in other areas to accommodate that? Is this something that the city is working on?
Well, that is, you know, that's the other option. And you can cut services, you can cut police and fire and parks services. But Bakersfield, there was a study came out a few years ago, and they looked at 107 cities, and Bakersfield had the least amount of government employees per capita of the whole 107. So Bakersfield's always been pretty fiscally conservative and has run a pretty tight ship all along. So at this point, you know, if you start cutting any more, you're definitely going to be services cut that people are used to seeing.
So you're saying there's not a lot of fat on the bones that Bakersfield can cut because you run relatively lean anyway?
Correct, yes.
So let's turn to this alternative scenario that you're looking at. The city council a few weeks ago voted to pursue exploring public sentiment on this tax idea. Mm-hmm. You're hiring a firm to conduct this survey at the cost of around $50,000. Why go about it that way?
Well, that seems to be what other jurisdictions have done. You know, you don't want to spend all the money to go to the people if it's absolutely no way, no how, you know, going to have an opportunity. So the idea is to go out in the community and really see what the sentiment is.
Is there an idea of how this tax might be structured or how you might present it even in this survey? What do you have there so far?
I think that's part of the survey is to, you know, try to figure out what people would accept or would not accept. You know, it's the idea is just a general sales tax. And again, the general fund funds police, fire, and, you know, those types of services. The sewer and water and trash, those are all enterprise funds, so they're not affected.
The city of Visalia has pursued some similar strategies over the years. In one case, they limited a tax increase, specifically earmarking those dollars to go to public safety. You know, tax dollars are fungible. I guess they could offset one area in the general fund or vice versa. But is that something that you think you would like to see Bakersfield pursue? Maybe putting some strings attached to any funding? Do you think that might get more support from the community?
You know, I'm not sure how that works. I know that other jurisdictions have done that, and then they've been sued because, you know, if you have a specific tax, you're supposed to get the 2/3 vote as opposed to the 50% for a general tax. Some of them do have associate measures, you know, that kind of direct the funds. But at this point, yeah, we're just exploring what the opportunities are.
So what's the next step here? What timeline are you looking at?
I think the survey is supposed to come back to us in March and, you know, with the data that we'll receive, then we'll decide which way to move forward.
For the upcoming budget year, are you considering what would happen if something like this doesn't go to voters and isn't approved?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for the upcoming, you know, our budget, we will adopt it in June, and you know, that's way too soon before next year, so we'll have to deal with the existing circumstances.
Bob Smith represents Ward 4 on the Bakersfield City Council, joining us today to talk about the city's cash crunch, looking at a budget gap that in 5 years' time, if nothing is done, some projections would put at around $15 million over that time. And again, the city is exploring ways to fix that, either through cuts or potentially a tax. We will follow that story as it moves forward. Bob, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Earlier this year, the Kern High School District settled a lawsuit that alleged its schools were using discriminatory disciplinary practices to suspend and expel students of color at a higher rate than white students. As a provision of their settlement, they agreed to reduce suspensions and expulsions and incorporate more restorative justice into their discipline. Simultaneously, some San Joaquin Valley educators were writing about alternative disciplinary practices in a new book that's been an Amazon bestseller in the school safety category, off and on, since it was published last year. FM89's Carrie Klein spoke with the husband and wife duo. FM89's Carrie Klein spoke with the husband and wife duo who wrote the book, Jessica Hannigan, a professor of educational leadership at Fresno State, and John Hannigan, a school principal in the Sanger Unified School District.
So the book is called Don't Suspend Me, and it's all about alternatives to what we consider, you know, typical disciplinary practices like suspensions and expulsions. So what was the inspiration for the book? What led you to write it?
The first reason, and the main reason, is really based on our experience and our research and work. Suspensions haven't really worked to change student behavior. It's been better for the adults at times to take a little break from the students, but, you know, when they come back, they're demonstrating the similar behaviors. So we wanted to really focus on what can we do that changes their behavior and teaches them from their mistakes, similar to academics. So how could we make this meaningful for them? And a lot of our colleagues didn't know what to do. So we wanted to give them a toolkit to help them make sure there was some alternative ways to intervene rather than just going straight to the suspension or expulsion.
Early on in my career as an administrator, I had the more of the traditional mindset that if a student did this, you consult the district handbook, and it says the student goes home for 3 days, they do it again, they're going home for 5 days, they do it again, they're going up for danger hearing. And seeing my discipline folder, it was really just really the same five kids that were repeatedly being sent home on the exclusionary practices. And so seeing that it was the same kids, obviously our approach to changing their behavior wasn't working. And so then that's where we'd start communicating with each other, hey, this is what I'm thinking about. you know, as far as to keep the student on campus so they're still in the learning environment, but give an alternative so that they're, you know, we're using that as an opportunity to teach and change behavior. And what we then found was their behaviors were changing. They weren't repeating their behaviors. And so we were actually writing a book about tiered behavior systems, but then having so many of our colleagues calling us on alternatives to discipline is where we saw the need for this book.
So before we get into some specifics, what are, you know, in really broad strokes, what are the main goals and the main strategies that you're trying to accomplish, you know, instead of just going right to suspensions?
We focus on the reflective, restorative, and instructional piece for every incident that, let's say, traditionally you would suspend for. So the reason we find this important is because these are the skills and behaviors these students need to learn for real life. This is what would happen in real life. And so we try to make it really meaningful. And the restorative piece really focuses on restoring the injustice between student-student, student-teacher, student community. The reflective piece really requires us to get to know the student to help them reflect on the poor decisions that they're making and really get them to think about how that impacts others. And then the instructional piece, which is something that's usually missing in discipline, which is ironic because discipline means to teach, is to actually teach them from real life examples and give them that opportunity to learn the skills they're missing when they're making these types of decisions. So those are the three main strategies or areas or components that we really recommend for each disciplinary action instead of just say sorry, go home for 3 days and come back and do it again. And during this type of discipline, we really recommend a collaborative approach. It's not just the admin or it's just not put on the teacher. It's a community approach. And through this process, when done correctly and implemented with fidelity, you get to know the student. You make a connection. You build that relationship.
And so in your book, you actually offer what you call an alternative discipline menu. Can you run through a couple of those items?
Just before we run through the items, we're very intentional to say you address students by name, by need. So we give this menu as a guide to get administrators and educators to think of an innovative, a different way of addressing behavior to get them started on how to do this. I'll give one example. So we had a case of some middle school girls bullying, surprise, surprise, online. And so we really wanted to address this intentionally because the main girl who was part of the bullying repeatedly was doing the same thing. Even when she was sent home, she was on another social media outlet doing the same thing. And so we really worked together as a team to put her alternative discipline in place. So the restorative piece was there, the actual apology letters to the students she impacted, the family she impacted. The reflective piece was there, getting her to really understand and put herself in someone else's shoes. So she had to interview some students who had been bullied. And then really the component that was very meaningful in this case for her was she ended up having to do what we call parent academies on online bullying. So she ended up becoming the person that had to give a certain amount of time to the community, to the school, and to the parents and teach them what online bullying looks like, what social media looks like, and what students may be demonstrating if they're being bullied, and what the parents could do to help. So she went from the main bully to this advocate who was providing parent academies and going to other schools and helping other kids. And that changed her forever. I mean, she's doing great things. She ended up graduating and she's really turned her life around when it comes to that. So that's one example of a case. But we give examples like that throughout the book.
So this sounds really exciting, but also really time intensive and requires a lot of resources of teachers, of administrators, of everyone involved. What kind of advice do you offer to these schools about how they can actually fit this into what is likely an already overloaded workload?
Well, I would say under the traditional, I guess, response, the typical major referral takes approximately 45 minutes of your time as an administrator. And that's not even factoring the student's time missed out of class, teacher's time to conduct an investigation to then, send a student home on a suspension. What the alternatives do by preventing the repeat behaviors, it is time intensive up front, but what you're doing is, as opposed to using a reactionary response, now it's a preventive model. So now you're not seeing those repeat behaviors, so you're not constantly doing those 45-minute repeat investigations.
I can imagine there might be a lot of people who'd hear this and think, you know, what a kid needs is just hard discipline. Kids are becoming too sensitive. We're handling with them with kid gloves. Like, what do you say to that?
We agree. They do need very firm discipline, but the discipline is not happening when they're at home without supervision, without getting those lessons. We need to really have kind of control over what we are teaching them. And the best scenario is partnering with the parents at home or the guardians at home. But what we've found is that's not always the case. And something else we hear a lot is they just need to go home. It's safer for the school if they go home after possibly a fight or a bullying situation. But what we ask is, what makes it safer 3 or 5 days after when they return and nothing really happened to intervene or make sure this wasn't happening again? And so that's kind of where we start when answering this question. And when done right, the way we're talking is the harder way. We have had students beg to be sent home for suspension instead when it's done the way that we're saying and some of our real model colleagues implement this.
Trust me, when we're talking about alternatives, what we're saying is that suspensions need to be reserved for the most egregious offenses. We're talking about, though, the 90% of suspensions that you see are defiance, you know, profanity, things like that aren't necessarily the most egregious things.
And this book's designed for if students are returning back to your campus. So the traditional 3-day, 5-day, 3-day, 5-day repeatedly isn't working. But in the cases that you do have the district office involved and you make a decision to remove a student from your campus, or it's like John said, the top 5 incidents, we still highly recommend that this teaching component and this alternative component is part of that student's transition plan and what they're getting in their other location as well. We think this is a bigger calling than just, you know, don't suspend kids. We think this could really save lives. If we could save the lives of these children or help them pick a better path to go down, eventually that's going to have an outcome on our community as well. So we may kick them out of our school or our classroom, but we're not kicking them out of the community making these poor decisions, and that's what ultimately happens in the cases that we really, you know, don't change those behaviors or invest in that time, at least to say that we did everything we could before that next level.
Great. Okay. Well, Jessica and John Hannigan, thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
The Hannigans will be publishing 2 more books about a particular framework for restorative justice this spring. Well, that does it for today's Valley Edition. You can send us an email, talk@kvpr.org. And when you're on the KVPR website, find our audio archives and our podcast as well, and download our new app, all online, kvpr.org. For Valley Edition's reporting team, Carrie Klein and Laura Tsutsui, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web chcf.org.